what I thought would be my final glimpse of Samia. The reminder of Devon sobers me. I pull away from Ashwin, sick to my stomach. I do not know how to stop wanting or needing him. Even now, while shivering once again, I crave a reprieve. But I have to fight the cold, if only to outlast the war. Our wing flyer soars over the stone temple that clings to the great cliff. The courtyard is empty, and the meditation pond frozen over, but the sparring circle has been cleared away of snow and ice for training. My last skill trial here was the first time I spilled blood. More memories of my childhood bombard me. The outer gate that locked us temple wards in and the rest of the world out. The meditation pond that I soaked my feet in on a warm summer's day. The chip in the temple wall I fired stones at with my slingshot. We descend to the courtyard and land in the sparring ring. I breathe in the trees and clouds, the crisp air filling me up. I have missed the wholesome scent of the mountains. Inda jumps down from the wing flyer and staggers for the corner of the courtyard. Halfway there, she bends over and retches. Our landing must have unsettled her stomach. I climb off after Ashwin and Pons and make a move to follow her. Pons waves me back. I'll check on her. He goes to Inda's side and holds her hair up. An ache digs into my breastbone. No matter what Admiral Rinba has against them being together, they deserve whatever happiness they wish. A petite, hunched old woman occupies the open temple doorway. An oil lamp illuminates Priestess Mita's wizened face and gray hair. I can feel the weight of her glower from here. She does not know why we have come. She simply has never liked me. She favored Jaya. I should have known my returning as a Rani still would not win her over. Ashwin starts for the priestess, and after a weary sigh, I go too.
Raja Tarek, Priestess Mita whispers.
Ashwin flinches, as he does every time someone mistakes him for his father. This is Prince Ashwin, I correct. Priestess Mita dips into a bow.
Pardon my error, Your Majesty. Where is Raja Tarek?
He was killed,
Ashwin answers levelly. He bore no affection for his father in life, and is not hypocritical in his death. His aloofness is in part to shield me, for I ended Tarek's reign. Ashwin is one of the few people I entrusted with the truth of his father's demise.
My condolences.
Priestess Mita ends on an awkward pause while examining my trousers.
We are honored you've come home, kindred Kalinda. Who are your companions?
I glance across the courtyard. Inda has finished retching, and Pons is walking her slowly over to us. Inda and Pons are visiting from the Southern Isles. The priestess straightens from her hunch.
Foreigners.
Friends, Ashwin amends. They're welcome in the Empire.
We leave off that they are Buddhas. Priestess Mita still believes Tarek's warped fallacy that Buddhas are soulless demons of the void. She does not know I am a Buddha, or a burner, the rarest and most feared of my kind.
As you wish, Your Majesty.
Priestess Mita recognizes her rudeness at leaving us out in the cold.
If you would please, I'll escort your party inside. We reserve the lower floor of the temple for honored benefactors. Our wards live separately, on the upper floor. You understand that we must protect our daughter's innocence.
I seal off a flare of anger. Protect them for what? To stand naked and blindfolded in the claiming chamber before a strange man, an honored benefactor, and let him look them over like prized sheep? Seeing my grinding jaw, Ashwin takes my hand.
We understand,
he says. But does he?
Thank you, priestess.
She sniffs, dismissing my show of temper, and leads us down the stairway alongside the cliff to the lower entrance. Inda and Pons catch up as the priestess ushers us inside. I scarcely viewed the benefactor's chambers the day I was claimed, but they are not as lavish as I recall. At the time, the gold leaf furniture, silk draperies, and brass lamps were extravagance beyond my imagination. My own quarters were cramped and plain, the colors drab as the stone walls encasing them. Now that I have experienced true affluence and luxury, I notice the patched holes in the draperies, the flaking leafing on the dinged furniture, and the faded bedspread and stringy tassels. These accommodations are far below the prince's privilege. Ashwin smiles at the priestess.
This will do nicely. Do you have a room for us?
Pons asks. Inda leans against him. I was wrong about her being queasy from the flight. She must have fallen ill. Priestess Mita scowls at them.
Though we've never allowed outsiders to stay here, we'll make an exception for the prince's companions.
I step forward to defend my friends, but Pons answers,
Your hospitality is appreciated.
The priestess snubs him with nary a glance.
Kindred, your companions must remain out of sight from our temple wards.
She means Pons and Inda. She cannot keep me locked down here.
As should you, your majesty. You'll find everything you need in your chamber. One of our sisters will bring your meals. When would you like the recipients of age shown to you?
Shown?
Ashwin questions. He hasn't come for a claiming, I snap. On the temple floor above us, girls of all ages, from infants to 18-year-olds, train to become whatever their benefactor claims them for. The girls of age are shown to the benefactor so he may select those he desires. Priestess Mita's confused gaze bounces to me.
Then why have you come?
The prince wanted to survey our temples, I say.
I offered to accompany him. But you didn't bring our supplies.
No, I start hesitantly.
We weren't aware you were expecting a delivery. We haven't received goods or necessities in over 3 moons. Surely the brethren must know of our shortage. I've sent them several letters.
The Brotherhood temples send a supply caravan every other new moon. They must have stopped once the rebels infiltrated the Imperial City. With the Empire in disarray, the Sisterhood temples have been forgotten. The Samia temple is the farthest away from Vani, and the most secluded. They must be running dangerously low on reserves. Except for a garden that is now snowed over. The sisters and wards are dependent upon the generosity of benefactors, who provide food and clothing in exchange for the privilege to come and claim wards.
We were unaware of your circumstance,
Ashwin says.
I'll remedy your shortage of supplies in haste.
I cannot puzzle out how he intends to fulfill his pledge, but his swift assurance appeases Priestess Mita.
Will you please show us to our chamber?
Pons asks the priestess. Inda has not spoken since we landed. She sways some on her feet, her pallor worsening by the second.
Right this way.
Priestess Mita bustles to the door that leads to the corridor. Pons lags back.
Can we trust her, Kalinda?
She may be rude, but she won't harm you. I rub Inda's arm. Go rest. They follow the priestess out, and a thought strikes me. I need another room as well. This chamber has only one bed. Priestess Mita must assume Ashwin retained me as his kindred. Sleeping in the same chamber with him would be disastrous. I need only catch a chill during the night, and seek out his comfort. My throat heats to an itch. I'll ask Priestess Mita for quarters of my own.
No need for that.
Ashwin runs his finger over the mantle and comes away with a clump of dust.
You can have the bed. I'll sleep on the floor.
He lowers to his haunches and stalks the hearth with kindling.
Did my father board in this room when he last visited?
His simple question carries a strained undertone. He did. I met Devon in the corridor outside this chamber. How different my life would be if he had been a benefactor and claimed me instead. Or had I never been claimed at all?
Kalinda, would you please?
Ashwin motions to the kindling piled in the hearth. I go to his side and press my finger to the firewood, coaxing in heat. My powers shine but are still tinged green. Just as the kindling ignites, sapphire sparks fly from my fingers. I quell my powers and sneak a glance at Ashwin. He was preoccupied with the woodpile and did not see. I imagine the blue sparks I saw moments ago evolving into cold, sapphire flames, and shiver. Ashwin throws a log onto the growing blaze.
Does the temple have a library?
Yes, on the upper floor.
I may find a text about the gate to the void.
Ashwin has an aptitude for research. If the gate's location is written in one of the library books, he will find it. Wait until tonight, when everyone's asleep. How will you solve the temple's supply shortage?
I don't know yet.
Crouched near the fire, he prods the logs with the fire iron.
Can you find out how dire it is?
Yes. I'm going upstairs now. Ashwin pushes a tired hand through his hair, which is still damp from the melted snow.
Will you tell the priestess the real reason why we've come? She should be made aware about our meeting with Huston.
I owe Priestess Mita no such explanation. She lost my esteem as a sister in the faith when she allowed the Raja's monstrous general to claim Jaya. The priestess should have protected her. She should have protected us both. Instead, she still preaches that men are our betters, our gods. My time in the world of men has taught me that any man worthy of my admiration would never force me to worship him. Moreover, Priestess Mita will be livid to discover the Buddha warlord is meeting us. Her concern will be for the wards. She is not entirely hard-hearted. But informing her of our plans will feel akin to asking permission, which, as her Rani, I am no longer inclined to do. Ashwin watches moodiness come over me, my stiffening features and pressed lips, and rises.
I can speak to her if that would be easier.
He detects the furious storm brewing inside me, but he cannot identify the origin. I cannot settle upon the right words to explain my upbringing, how it feels to be raised for the sole use of another, to exist to fulfill another's whims and desires, and taught to never think of my own wants or needs. I never had to enlighten Devon. He saw firsthand the damaging effects of his mother's service as a courtesan. But Ashwin was too sheltered in his youth to grasp the destructive, selfish nature of the supremacy his birthright entitles him to wield. With a flick of his finger, he may claim any girl in this temple or in the whole of the empire. Still, even after I have ended Raja Tarik's tyranny, even though I am a 2-time tournament champion and the kindred, even with Ashwin striving to improve upon his father's legacy, the unjust division of rights still reigns. I'll take care of it, I say, picking up a lamp. I go into the corridor and start for the stairway. My injured knee aches, and I could use a long nap, but I cannot wait to see the only person left at the temple who I consider my friend. I take the long route to the infirmary, to bypass Jaya's and my former bedchamber. I cannot bear to view our place of happiness or confront those memories. By now, 2 different wards are dwelling in our haven, replacing us as though our friendship never was. But the ghost of Jaya entwines with the sandalwood incense burning in the halls. She is everywhere, in the walls, in the floors, in my heart. Running from her is pointless, so I allow the loss of stolen wishes to fester. My longing for her is deeper than any other ache or pain I carry. The door to the infirmary stands open. I enter and survey the vacant cots. The strong aroma of medicinal chamomile unburies a landslide of memories. Most of my childhood was spent in this chamber, endless days lying in a sickbed with raging fevers. Healer Baka jots in her patient log at her desk. Her spectacles have slid down her nose, perched on the end. When she lifts her quill to dab on more ink, my shadow pulls her attention upward. She inclines back in her chair on a whispered prayer.
Thank Anu.
old, held-in anger charges out of me.
Did you ask Anu to send you a burner?
Healer Baka concealed the truth of my Buddha heritage to protect me from Tarek's hatred for my kind. Though her justifications were well-founded, I have yet to recover from her deception.
Brother Sean wrote me to say you're full into your powers. Her voice brims with pride. Let me have a look at you.
She comes and turns me into the light. I haven't changed much. I'm still thin as bamboo.
Haven't changed. You're a Rani.
She skims her palm up my cheek, her eyes shining.
You've become the woman the gods intended.
I tuck her hand away.
Jaya?
My voice shreds to a rasp, and before I can stop them, tears pour down my cheeks.
Jaya's dead.
Healer Baka enfolds me in her arms. No one else knew Jaya as well as I did, except for Baka. When Jaya died, I had no one to mourn her with, no one who fathomed my bereavement.
She's well, Kali. Jaya was good and pure. She'll have a new life in her new form, and her loving spirit will continue to bless others. You may miss her, but do not mourn her. You will meet her again.
I hold Baka tighter, clinging to her sentiments.
You truly think so? Time is relative in the beyond. Jaya will be born again, and you will reunite with her in another life.
My crying lessens to quiet hiccups. Healer Baka goes to close the door most of the way for privacy. Passerby would find it suspicious to find the infirmary sealed off.
Brother Sean hasn't written since your wedding. I began to worry.
A lot has changed since I left. I set aside my grief to deliver the news. Brother Sean passed away. Healer Baka draws into herself. She and Sean had a long-distance friendship that began in Vani years ago. They trusted each other implicitly.
I've missed more than I realized, she says.
Why don't I tell you everything over a hot drink? I am cold, and Healer Baka keeps the most delicious herbal tea mixes. While she prepares the tea, I relay all that has happened. Unloading the burden of my loss for Jaya opens a floodgate of confessions. Falling in love with Devon, murdering Tarek, my expansion of burner powers, and Ashwin unleashing the Voider. The only part I omit is Healer Migo's prognosis of my condition. Baka listens, interrupting only once for clarification about the Voider returning in the physical form of Tarek. Long after we sip the last of our tea, I finish my summary and await her reaction.
I'm at a loss, she says. You and Natesha are friends?
Out of everything I told you, that surprises you most?
You forget that I helped raise you. I've seen stray cats get along better than you two.
I chirp a laugh. Well, it wasn't without effort.
Kali, I'm so glad to see you again, but you shouldn't have returned.
My chin ticks sideways at her reprimand.
Your health is poor. I can tell you're hurting more than you let on.
I'm fine, I say, fiddling with my teacup. Her expression does not change.
Even if that were true, you shouldn't have agreed to meet Hostin here. He's too dangerous.
He picked Samia for our meeting place. I wouldn't have considered accommodating him, but the demon Raja is marching on Vani as we speak.
Healer Baka pulls back slightly. Your intentions for coming here aside, you've brought more mouths to feed. We're living off our fall harvest.
The prince is aware and has promised to arrange for aid. I leave out that he has no idea how he will do so, and Healer Baka notices. She pushes her spectacles up her nose in a quick jerk, still troubled. I won't let anything happen, I say, a guarantee that, even to me, sounds more convincing. She holds my solemn gaze.
I have to tell Priestess Mita. For the good of our daughters, she needs to know.
I lock my jaw. The priestess sent me to die in Raja Tarek's rank tournament.
You lived.
But Jaya didn't.
Healer Baka lays her hand over mine.
Priestess Mita's strongest virtue is obedience. She submitted completely to the Raja, perhaps to a fault. But you know as well as I do that she couldn't have stood up to him. I uncross my legs and rub my sore knee. I can no sooner rid myself of its ache than I can set aside my resentment for the priestess, or my longing for a future with Jaya.
Let me give you something for your leg. Healer Baka rummages through her herb cabinet and takes out a jar. I'll mix a salve for the pain.
An aquifer has been healing me. She's very gifted.
Healer Baka lowers her chin and peers over her spectacles at me.
Not all gifted healers are aquifers.
She hands me parchment and a piece of charcoal and then waves at the cot in the corner, the one that was once mine. Jaya used to sit beside me and watch me sketch for hours.
This won't take long. Have a seat and draw while you wait.
I should return to the lower floor, but I do not trust myself alone with Ashwin, and I have not sketched in so very long. This opportunity to create is too precious to squander. I settle into the lumpy straw mattress while Healer Baka crushes herbs at her workbench. The fragrance of brewed tea and chamomile strokes my nose. Although Jaya's place remains empty beside me, I press the charcoal stick to the parchment and draw as though she is watching.
10. Devon. My lungs and legs burn. Night left long ago, but the day has been in less of a hurry to end. All day long we have jogged over fields and marshes, side-footed down deep gullies and marched up slippery hills, yet the Imperial Army is still in front of us. In the past hour their tracks have led us into an autumn forest. The sunset streams through the trees that are thick with auburn leaves and the scent of inbound rain. The leaves' redness, illuminated by the light, reminds me of Kali's fire. Dragon in Eresh. Fierce and bold, awe-inspiring. Just like the woman who summoned it. My comrade's pace slows to a grinding walk. I am tired, but not as tired as they. My urgency to find Brock fuels my strength. But I cannot run forever. The farther we trek, the more certain I am that my brother was captured, and the less I can deny that this is my fault. A moon ago, I let Brock and Mother stay behind in Tarachand. Before leaving Janardan, I sent Opal and Rowan, two young Galers, hardly old enough to live on their own, to find them, instead of going after them myself. Both decisions led to this plight. Rowan falls back, nearly out of view. Yatin and Natesha tread closer, shuffling through the fallen leaves. Trails and trails of broken branches lie before us, trodden down by heavy wagons and soldiers. Somewhere far ahead, leading the troops, is the Demon Raja.
Devon, Yatin says, panting. How much longer?
Natesha lags behind, clutching her side. Rowan stumbles after her, even farther in the rear. None of us wants to risk not returning to the wing flyer in time to meet with the Navy, but we cannot continue through the night. I stop with Yatin. My knees wobble, close to giving out.
Stay here with the others. I'll pull ahead and then circle back.
Yatin bends over to catch his breath.
You'll be of no use to Brock exhausted.
Exhausted is better than absent. I swipe at perspiration dripping in my eyes and mumble an explanation.
This is my comeuppance. The gods aren't punishing you, Devon. You're punishing yourself.
I rest on a raised tree root. Finding Brock is paramount, but so are the welfare and condition of my friends. I should never have separated from my family. Yatin sits, his bearded face sweaty and flushed.
As I recall, Brock offered to stay behind. Seems to me you're angry about something else.
My friend may be big, but he has never been slow. Kali and the prince arranged to meet the warlord in Samia. I tried to talk her out of it, but her mind was set. I have had plenty of time to mull over why she sided against me, and I will relent on one point. Prince Ashwin and Kali must do all within their power to protect the empire, but depending on the warlord is still a bad idea. Kali supports the prince's efforts. Kalinda has a will of her own, and a strong one at that. He did not walk in on her cozied up to Ashwin, otherwise he would not try to reassure me by touting her strong will. Yatin pats his trouser pocket, and then pats it again. He switches to his other pocket and takes out the lotus ring. God's mercy, I thought I'd lost it. I start to ask why he has not yet given Natesha the ring, but I hold my question when she staggers up to us.
Praise the skies! You stopped!
She uncorks her flask and gulps down water. While she is drinking, Yatin slips the ring away. She passes him the flask, and he draws a long pull. Rowan straggles closer, a few strides away. Rest up, I say, adjusting my pack. The straps dug bruising valleys into my shoulders while I was running. I'm going ahead.
Give us a minute, and we'll go with you.
Natesha flaps a tired hand at the distance. Lights have appeared in the trees, visible in the twilight. We have caught up to the army. Son of a scorpion. I drop behind a log. Yatin pulls Natesha down, and they kneel beside me. Rowan teeters up to us and slumps over, lounging on a leaf pile. I would lie down too, if I thought I could get up again. I drop my pack to lighten my load. Yatin and Natesha, stay here. Rowan and I will go ahead and stake out the camp while it's dark.
Why do I have to go?
Rowan gripes, his young voice breaking.
I'm starved.
He has not complained once during our trek. I hesitate to push him further, but we are here to find Opal and Brock, and I need Rowan to do so. I grasp the back of his shirt and lift him. Fortunately, he is not fully grown, or I would not have the strength. I need your sharp hearing. Are any scouts nearby? Rowan listens to the breeze stirring the branches above.
No, but the soldiers setting up camp are loud, so I could be missing them over the ruckus.
Scouring the army's camp could take us all night. Rowan's exceptional hearing is the only chance we have of succeeding. Expect our return by dawn, I tell Yatin. Be on watch.
Eat before you go,
says Natesha, passing out rations. I force down several bites of dried fish. The briny taste clings to my tongue like barnacles. I drain my water flask and give Rowan the rest of my fish. He shoves the chunk into his mouth, his cheeks bulging, and we set out. The nearer we creep to the army, the wider the hole in my stomach expands. Torches extend so far into the distance, I cannot make out the other end of camp. Rowan and I carefully navigate the leaf-strewn forest, sneaking closer to the men, horses, and tents. We stop in the shadows and duck low in the brush. Torchlights illuminate the peaks of several buildings. Barracks. This is not just a camp. The army has stopped at a military outpost. My mind spins to figure out which one. Yatin is the more proficient navigator, but if I remember right, the closest outpost to the location where Brock and Opal crashed was well within the Tarachand border. The army has traveled farther than I presumed. Should they continue their grueling pace, they will reach Vani a day ahead of schedule, and do so with swelling ranks. This outpost houses 500 men, all of whom will be eager to join the Imperial Army under the direction of their returned Raja. Their numbers are already large. They must have recruited while marching. When the army left Eresh, they could not have had more than 2,000 men, both sworn-in soldiers and volunteer citizens. Now, their ranks are vast, I estimate the army is composed of several infantry units, a light cavalry, and archers. But I am unable to accurately tally the army's headcount in the dark. Perhaps it is better that I cannot discern how big their camp is, or else I might turn away. Unbending from my crouch, I signal for Rowan to lead on. The trees shield us as we dart across an opening to the backside of a barrack. He listens for stray guards, then shakes his head. We have not been discovered. I peer around the corner. Soldiers mill about between the pitched tents, cleaning their jackets and brushing off their boots. Many wear no military garb, but they fly the Tarachand colors, a black scorpion on a red backdrop. Though they are short on uniforms, they have plenty of weapons. Khandas, pilates, and machetes are propped against every tent. Wagons full of food and water are parked intermittently across camp. A massive wooden catapult rests off to the side. Wagons brimming with ammunition, bolts, and boulders outnumber those hauling food supplies. I rejoin Rowan and whisper, "Any trace of Brock or your sister?"
"Nothing."
Rowan's huge eyes are even wider than normal. He looks so young.
"We should turn back. Something isn't right. When I reach for the wind, it doesn't come."
A breeze flows over us. "I don't know what you mean."
"Something is stopping the wind's whisperings."
A gong rings far off. I draw farther into the shadows. Rowan fits his thin back tighter against the wall, his chin lifted. The lump of his voice box protrudes from his elongated throat. The barrack door slams, rattling the wall. I look around the corner again. The men inside the building have left. All the soldiers are moving to the center of camp.
"Let's go."
I tug on Rowan's sleeve.
"Stay close."
We slip into the empty tents. Rowan does as I ask, sticking to my side. I toss him a soldier's jacket that was left behind. I am still wearing mine. He slips it on, and the two long sleeves hang past his knuckles. I hand him a machete and select a khanda for myself. The familiar military-grade sword feels right in my hand. But the wrongness of standing in the Imperial Army's camp as a traitor makes me restless. If I do not belong here, where do I belong? Gripping our blades, we tiptoe to the nearest barrack, and I open the heavy door. Bunks and cots and personal bags fill the one-room building. I back out and we go to the next barrack, and then the next. I assumed the Demon Rajah would hold captives in a more secure shelter than a tent, but none of the barracks we investigate house prisoners. At my questioning glance, Rowan shakes his head. He has not heard our siblings. I consider returning to Yatin and Natesha, but our search has led us deep into the campsite. The soldiers congregate ahead. We work our way through them in search of another barrack, skimming the perimeter as much as possible. When we have no choice but to move within the throng, a voice cuts through the night.
"Welcome, troops."
Raja Tarek stands above the crowd on a platform that rings the outpost's water tower. His dark hair is trimmed short, like his tidy beard. His rather average physique is made regal by the finery of his tunic and trousers. His puffed-out chest and calculating gaze exude an inherent arrogance that demands esteem. Even when he stands on equal ground with others, he has a habit of looking down his nose at people. His charismatic, boyish smile and smooth voice counterbalance his majestic poise, trickeries that convince his subjects they can trust him. A deception I once fell for. "He's not Tarek," I remind myself, "or his son." Rowan tugs on my jacket, warning me to stay back, but I slip farther into the audience, so we'd better blend in.
"You are a marvelous sight."
Criers repeat the Demon Raja's pronouncement to the outer reaches of the audience. The soldiers cheer for their leader. But this counterfeit version of Tarek possesses a malevolence to his voice that the tyrant Raja was careful not to exhibit in public. The demon Raja, Udug, lifts his arms.
Today, we welcomed 500 men into our ranks. Many of them were run out of Vani and their comrades were beheaded by Bhutas.
Udug sneers on the word. They tell me the Bhuta's corrupt leader, the traitorous warlord, sits on my throne. But his rebellion will not prevail. With the gods behind us, we will unseat these vermin from our imperial city and send every last soulless demon back to the void. The men applaud a liar. He is the vermin they need to eradicate. Udug signals to guards waiting below. Up the ladder they haul a man wearing a green uniform, a Janardanian soldier. His yellow armband distinguishes him as a Bhuta. They throw him onto the platform at the demon Raja's feet. The prisoner's wrists bleed from where his captors let his blood.
"This abomination is a Galer," announces Udug.
The spectators boo and spit, and Rowan sidles closer to my side.
"This demon can read your thoughts. He can hear your inner fears, even from far away, and use them against you."
Rowan blanches. Galers can do no such thing.
"Our prisoner told me the warlord is aware of our approach. The rebels are fortifying Vani in preparation for our arrival, but the warlord does not know all."
Udug's smugness drives fear into my gut.
"We have contacted 4 more imperial outposts. All of them have employed their units to join us. By the time we reach Vani, we will be 10,000 men strong."
A hard lump drops in my belly. The army will be more than double the size of the Lestarian Navy. Rowan's voice trembles in my ear.
"I don't know how the Demon Raja is managing it, but he's directing sound away from camp."
"He is the source of the lull?"
"Bhuta powers don't exist in the Evernight. It's as though the area around him is the void."
A frightening deduction. Yet Rowan may be onto something. Udug was unharmed by Bhuta powers when he conquered Iresh. Even Kali's fire could not drive him back. Perhaps he wears his connection to the void like armor. Good Anu, please let us be mistaken. If Bhutas cannot harm Udug, no matter how big an army we amass, he will be unstoppable.
"We have allowed this atrocity to live long enough," the demon Raja calls. "The gods have granted me permission and bestowed upon me the authority to vanquish Bhutas from our world. In honoring my duty, I cast this demon out on behalf of myself and all other faithful souls."
He lowers his glowing blue hands to the Galer's head. Instead of pouring his cold fire into the man, he causes light to thread out of his victim. He parches the Janardanian soldier like a burner can, except Udug does not stop sucking out the Galer's soul fire as Kali or Brock would. He feeds off the Galer, gulping down his inner light. I turn Rowan away. He grasps my arm tightly as the Galer's agony-filled scream distills all sound. Then Udug finishes, and the Bhuta crumbles. The demon Raja's fingers cast an eerie blue glow over the cheering soldiers. I tug on Rowan for us to leave, but someone I recognize climbs onto the platform. Manas stands at Udug's right-hand side, dressed in a navy blue military uniform and carrying a talwar, a single-edged curved sword. When I last saw Manas, I knocked him unconscious. He tried to kill Rowan, Opal, and me, and I thought to do the same to him. But before all that, we were friends. Before his hatred for Buddhas warped him. Before he accused me of treason and tried to have me executed. Before he turned me in, and I was lashed 30 times. Manas steps over the dead Dardanian. 2 soldiers roll the deceased off the platform. The corpse hits the ground and Rowan's shoulders jolt at the thud. Manas speaks privately with Udug. Even at a distance, I can see the demon's eyes flash blue. Rowan tips up onto his toes to listen, but he still cannot hear what they are saying. At last they finish, and the demon Raja makes another announcement to the troops.
General Manas has notified me that our scouts spotted rebel informants close to camp.
General? Udug entrusted Manas with the highest rank in the Imperial Army? My position, or the one I rejected?
Our enemies are hiding in the forest not far from here. I will personally reward a bottle of Apong and 300 coins to the 1st soldiers who find them and bring them back, dead or alive.
Great skies, Natesha and Yatin.
Countless soldiers are motivated by the reward, which is 4 times their annual wage. The throng snatches up weapons and torches and sets off into the forest.
What do we do now?
Rowan's last word pinches off in a squeak. I pluck a torch from a post and start for the woodland. We find Natesha and Yatin before they do.
11. Kalinda. I sway in the creaky rocking chair, the view before me dipping and rising. Out the casement, a sea of frosted evergreens dominates the lower mountain ranges. Above them, sharp slopes and craggy apexes thrust into the clouds. The mountains are so familiar, they are like gazing at a friend's face. The early cold almost dampens the scent of shedding pine needles. Beside me, the North Tower beacon radiates warmth, shielding me from the night, and its light furthers my view across the forest. Bits of white lay across the shadowy landscape and lakeshore. Cupped in the mountain trenches, the lake is capped by a hard sheen of glittering ice. Even in the summer, the crystalline waters are too cold for swimming. Some say monsters lurk in the frigid depths, but I am more inclined to fear the Alpana Mountain's mighty summit, Wolf's Peak, the land goddess's foremost monument to her domain. Jaya believed Wolf's Peak was Ikar, the hallowed location where the mortals' realm intersects with the gods. No one knows the actual whereabouts of their mountain house, except that it is somewhere in the Alpanas. Looking up at the pointed apex, I can easily trust that Wolf's Peak pierces the sky god's vast realm. I am less comfortable with the notion that the gate to the void, supposedly a cavern to the underground, is hidden in these knolls. Snowflakes drift in through the open casement. I huddle deeper into the wool blanket that I borrowed from the infirmary, and I rock in the lookout chair. I came directly to the secluded tower upon leaving Healer Baka. The salve she rubbed into my knee eased the aching, but even though the beacon emanates warmth, the voider's poison still gnaws into my bones. A fire dragon crouches in the beacon's flame. I do not send the manifestation of my soul's reflection away, nor does it snap or hiss to gain my attention. The fire dragon waits patiently for my command, a pup sitting dutifully alongside its master. A wolf howls in the far-off hills. The lonely call sends my gaze to the road. Huston will arrive that way. It is the only thoroughfare in or out of Samia. I will watch for him and meet him outside the temple gate. He will not come any closer to my home until we have an alliance. As night dawdles on, the snow on the casement ledge deepens. I burrow into my blanket, and the folded parchment in my pocket rustles. While Healer Baka prepared the salve for my leg, I sketched a picture. Though it had been a while since I indulged in drawing, I labored over the details. I open the drawing and examine Oshwin's face. In my rendition of the prince, shadows obscure half of his profile. Remorse and blame draw down his mouth, and in his eyes, sorrow coils. He has worn this precise expression every day since he unleashed Udug. Ashwin's self-blame troubles me. Every day Udug roams free and unchallenged, Ashwin's regret intensifies. The only good to come of it is that he looks less and less like his father. Tarek never regretted any of his actions. My deepest, most painful memories originate from him. Not only what he did to me, but what I was led to do to him. I smothered and poisoned his soul fire just as Udug is doing to me. Tarek deserved to die, not only for killing Jaya, but I loathe being his monster just as he is mine. A sudden wind sweeps through the tower. The strong gust extinguishes the beacon and my loyal fire dragon. Cast into the dark, I feel my neck hairs prickle.
Your drawing flatters me, love.
I draw my daggers and jump up. My sketch of Ashwin falls to my feet. Tarek manifests in the darkness at the rear of the tower, away from the reflecting snow. More shadow than man, his grainy shape is like a pillar of sand. Tarek evaluates the sketch, now ruined by the damp floor.
You've missed me.
That isn't you.
My son, then.
He tips his head back, thinking over that coupling.
You'll tire of him. Ashwin doesn't have the same fire inside him to mold the world with, as we do.
I raise my blades higher. How did you find me? He must have traveled by shadows. The Evernight exists beyond the light, confined to the dark. But that is little comfort at midnight.
You summoned me, my wife.
At my instant protest, he says,
You thought of me, did you not?
I did think of Tarek, though only in relation to his son. Then again, when Tarek visited me in the Pearl Palace, it was after I thought of the demon Raja disguised as him.
Put away your daggers. Your blades cannot harm me.
He slides forward to the fringe of the shadows, but comes no farther.
You were boorish that last time I visited. I could have chosen to ignore your summons, but as I said before, I must warn you.
I need no warning from you.
You do if you and Ashwin aim to locate the gate to the void.
Tarek smirks at my shocked withdrawal.
Ah, yes. You are searching for the gateway. I could tell you where it is, but you must come closer.
He reaches for me, still circumventing the barest of light.
It's been so long since I've touched your hair.
My skin squirms. You'll never touch me again.
Then you will never find the gate, and without it Udug will rove free. But I must warn you, Udug can find the gate. And should he be the one to open it?
A leaden warning unfurls in my chest. Udug would only open the void for an awful purpose. What do you want in return? Satisfaction lightens his voice.
One small request, really. All I ask is that you summon me at the gate. Simply stand before the entry and call my name.
Nothing is ever simple or harmless with Tarek. But a greater threat roams the mortal realm. Where's the gate?
Your pledge first, love.
Not until you tell me where it is.
Then you shall never know.
Tarek's gaze strokes down my body.
You've always reminded me of Unleal's 100th Rani. Does it strike you as prophetic that we never learned her name? Of all the Fire God's wives, we learned only of her. Yet we only know of her in association to him. Her reputation lives on in infamy because she wed a powerful man. I too have blessed your life, Kalinda. Let me help you again.
I swipe my dagger at his murky chest, purposely missing. Go back down the hole you crawled out of. His eyes smolder, two sable pits.
Your temper will be your undoing. Udug will crush your world.
Tarek glides backward deeper into the shadows. Wait. He pauses, his lips curling smugly. I edge forward, stopping before the toes of my boots touch the gloom he dwells in. If you care anything for your son or me, you'll help us.
Doesn't my coming here prove that I love you?
He beckons me nearer with his same vainglorious grin. The tips of my toes crest the darkness. A cold tingles, alive and crawling with tentacles. Tarek sidles up to me and grabs a handful of my hair. He lifts my locks to his nose and inhales.
Breathing you in is like drinking midnight.
Where's the gate, Tarek? His gritty hand brushes down my cheek. I force myself to remain still. This could redeem you. Anu could forgive your indiscretions and invite you to the beyond.
The beyond will never have me. I wish to return to the mortal realm.
Tarek's grip tightens on my hair.
Udug stole my empire, but my name and power belong to me.
I try tugging away, but Tarek pulls harder, dragging me into the darkness. A blackout obscures me, a whirlwind of dust and grime. Rough lips slam down on my mouth. I cannot breathe or see past the filth. A rush of panic throttles me, and I drive my dagger into his chest. The blade sinks up to my knuckles into squirming quicksand. Tarek chuckles into my ear.
Should you choose to behave and respect your husband, all you need to do is request my company, and I will come.
His dusty form disintegrates around me, vanishing to empty shadows. I draw in gasps of unsullied night air and search inside myself for my dying soul fire. Finding my inner flame, shrunken and weak, I tremble on the precipice of the Evernight.
12. Devon. Torches bob around Rowan and me, like large fireflies illuminating the dark. We blend in with the other soldiers fanning out through the forest. Difficult as it is not to run ahead, we stay in the thick of the hunt. But as the troops disperse into smaller groups, we break out in front of the other search parties. Soon our torch is the only one for 100 strides in every direction. We finally arrive at the place we last saw our comrades. The leafy covert is vacant.
Where did they go?
Rowan asks, turning about. I don't know. They were not taken. No one from camp has searched farther out than this. The torchlights must have spooked them. I would suggest that Rowan send them a message on the wind, a whistle or a bird call, but torchlights close in on us. Too many men could become suspicious of our signal or any response our friends would send. I sweep the torch over the ground and uncover a footprint of Jotun's boot. As a boy, he often hid from his 5 older sisters so they could not dress him up like a doll, or, when he grew older, saddle him with their chores. He would only leave a footprint if he intended for me to find it. This way. I hurtle over a fallen log and discover another footmark every few strides. Rain begins to patter, dampening the fallen leaves to sticky mush and filling Jotun's tracks with puddles. The drizzle drenches my turban, but does not deter the mob or hamper their determination. Torchlights press farther into the forest as the hunt goes on. A shout comes from directly ahead. A rebel! My insides vault up to my throat. Rowan and I set into a run, along with dozens of other men. We come to a halt at the gathering of lights. A man dressed all in black grasps an Imperial soldier by the neck with both hands. Droplets of blood cry from the soldier's eyes and seep out of every pore of his exposed skin. A soldier across the circle releases a bolt from his crossbow, striking the man in black in the spine. He arches in agony and collapses. The Imperial soldier he strangled and bled falls with him, both landing in a heap. Another man checks them over. The rebel and his assailant are dead. The horde clambers over one another to claim the prize. Ultimately, the party with the soldier who shot the crossbow hoists the rebel and carries him back to camp. The rest of the hunters trickle after them, grumbling over the lost opportunity for coin. Bloodstains cover the fallen soldier's body. The rain dilutes the scarlet drops to streams of pink running across his skin.
"What did the rebel do to him?" I ask.
Rowan curls into himself, a statue of misery.
"Aquifers can leach the water out of someone's body little by little. Leaching is wrong. Buddhas should use their powers for good, or we're no better than demons."
Opal once told me the same thing about winnowing, when she explained a galer can siphon air from another's lungs, asphyxiating them to death. Rowan cries silent tears, but I doubt they are for the rebel or the soldier. He must be thinking of the galer the demon Raja executed, and his sister. I pat his thin back. "Tonight has been difficult, but I need you to stay tough." Rowan wipes his nose and nods glumly. The soldiers' torches drift farther away, leaving us suspiciously alone. I regret not pausing to bury or pray over the fallen soldier, but time is short. "We need to return to camp to keep up appearances," I say. "After everyone turns in for the night, we'll sneak away and search for Natesha and Yatin." Rowan falls in line with me, my feet dragging more with every stride. 2 days of little food and even less rest hit me at once. It is all I can do not to keel over. Halfway to camp, Rowan halts, and a sudden wind extinguishes our torch. The dark wicks away my exhaustion. I back up against a tree, my conda ready. Something hefty drops from above. Peering into the dimness, I distinguish Yatin's shape. A smaller shadow also leaps down.
"A mighty Anu," I whisper. "You could have warned me, Rowan."
He heard our friends and blew out the torch to mask their presence.
"Where's the excitement in that?"
Natesha thumps me on the chest. Although meant to be a playful jibe, the cuff hurts my tired body. "I found your tracks, Yatin."
"I tried to leave more," he answers, "but too many soldiers were around. Any trace of Brock or Opal?"
"No, but the demon Raja held a Galer prisoner, so he could have others."
General of the Imperial Army or not, as the organizer of this mission, I cannot allow my friends to follow me any farther. I'm going back to camp before everyone turns in for the night. The army is vast and growing. I'll blend in and search for Brock and Opal on the march to Vani. You three return to the wing flyer and meet with the Lestarian Navy.
"What about General Manas?" Rowan asks.
"Manas is here?"
Natesha asks.
"And he's the general?"
She and Yatin scoff in reproach. Both are acquainted with Manas's and my history.
"Devin, he'll kill you if he finds you."
"He won't, or he'll be sorry." Regardless of our past friendship, my mercy for Manas is long spent. A gong resounds in the distance. That's the call for curfew. I have to go. Natesha grabs my arm, holding me in place.
"Not without us, you don't. We took too long to find the army. We're supposed to meet with the Navy day after tomorrow. Even if we run all night, we'll never make it in time."
"Then wait here, and I'll come back for you."
"No."
Her grip tightens.
"When my sister was claimed and taken from the temple, I never saw her again. The next I heard, she'd passed away."
Rowan grimaces, and she tempers her tone.
"I didn't get a chance to go after my sibling like you and Rowan have. Tomorrow morning, all of us will join the army and march to Vani."
Yatin crosses his arms over his chest.
"The army will punish a female infiltrator differently than a man."
"Then I'll pretend I'm a man,"
Natesha counters.
"I'll wear a uniform and hide my hair. I won't get caught."
Yatin is right to worry. Neither of us would ever mistreat a female prisoner or abuse our rank to coerce a woman. But some soldiers take repulsive liberties. Natesha would be more at risk for certain acts of violence than us men. I can hardly guarantee my safety, let alone hers. Udug executed the Galer I mentioned, I inform her. For your protection, you should all turn back.
You can accept